Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia, solar-topia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We went digging into the ground, into the oceans, into the forests, into our own brains, unfortunately, to burn many things we found, and wound up with, among other things, nuclear power and a Soviet nuclear industry. We are here today at the Solartopia show, the Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman, and you were just listening to Pete Seeger and the great Dar Williams, along with David Burns, singing the Solartopia song, a Grammy-winning song. Was on the album Tomorrow's Children with Rivertown Kids. And today we've got some grim news, unfortunately, but a good guest named Ryan Grimm. Ryan, you're with us?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, from the Huffington Post. You've written a piece about the resignation of Gregory Jaczko. We'll get to that in a second. Also, Ken Silverstein. Ken, you're with us?
I'm here.
From Energy Biz. We're going to talk, we're going to start about, as we usually do on the show, with the latest horrible news from nuclear power, the nuclear power industry. This one is really frightening as far as I'm concerned. But before we jump in on Gregory Jaczko, chair of the nuclear, current chair, and soon to be no longer chair, he's been sent to Siberia, of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I do need to feel compelled to raise, having worked with nuclear power since 1973, almost 40 years now, there are a few things that freak me out, but I have to say there is a article I've posted at nukefree.org. It's an interview with Michio Kaku, the great physicist. The fate of the world hangs at Fukushima 4. Now, we've talked about this on the show before. It's hard for something like this to sink in, the gravity of it. And gentlemen, feel free to comment if you like, please. But since March 11th, 2011, the spent fuel pool at Fukushima Unit 4 has been suspended in the air. The geniuses who devised these nuclear reactors decided it would be really neat to stick the spent fuel pools for General Electric reactors 100 feet in the air, so that when they pull the fuel out of the, I guess this is why they did it. So maybe it was a practical joke. I don't know, but the spent fuel pool is pulled out of the reactor cores, and since it's suspended with a crane, they just thought it'd be neat to put the pool 100 feet in the air. I feel like Harry Shearer on the show saying this. The spent fuel pool for the radioactive fuel coming from nuclear power plants designed by General Electric are 100 feet in the air. And so, of course, when the disaster hit at Fukushima, and Unit 4 wasn't even online, as I believe, the structure underneath the spent fuel pool essentially disintegrated. And we now have, this bathtub that's hanging in the air, God knows, with tons of, literally tons of the most lethal substances ever created, these radioactive fuel rods, generally, for lack of a better term, described as spent, but hardly, if you stood within 10, 20 yards of these spent fuel pools, you'd be dead in 5 minutes, if that. And so we now have at least one spent fuel pool suspended in midair, and God forbid an earthquake should hit, which everybody, by the way, who studies earthquakes is dead certain it will hit at Fukushima again. God forbid this thing come crashing to the ground with no water, no cooling. It would be, according to Michio Kaku, and the article posted at nukefree.org is Michio Kaku, "The Fate of the World Hangs at Fukushima 4." It was published on WordPress, actually. I pulled it off WordPress. It's terrifying. It's one of the most terrifying things that I have ever read. Ryan or Ken, are you familiar with what the situation is at Fukushima?
No, I mean, what would be the consequence if that cracked and broke out?
Well, what would happen is that the spent fuel pool rods, which weigh tens of tons collectively, would fall to the ground, and we would be uncovered, and with no cooling. And the geniuses who devised this technology decided that they were going to clad the their uranium pellets inside that make the reactors go. And these pellets are put into long tubes. They're not, I don't know, they're an inch and a half in diameter maybe, and they're what, 30 feet long or so. Ken, maybe you know exactly, but I assume they vary from reactor to reactor actually. So then they are put in arrays. They are locked into grids and separated. In other words, this fuel rods are separated, I don't know, a foot or two maybe, and then the neutron radiation from the enriched uranium causes the chain reaction. And so the fuel rods sit in metal cladding in a metal array, which is basically a grid, suspended from each other by, a foot or so. Thousands of them, weighing tens of tons, and they when they get going, when they achieve critical mass, neutron fueled chain reaction occurs, and these fuel rods get incredibly radioactive. You can actually hold a uranium pellet in your hand before it goes into a nuclear reactor. When it comes out of the nuclear reactor, you will die. In a very short period of time if you hold it in your hand. And so the problem now is if they're not kept cool after they're used, and after they can no longer sustain a chain reaction of neutrons sufficient to power an atomic reactor, then they are pulled out of the reactor and they're sat in swimming pools, essentially, filled with water. And they have to be filled with water at all times to keep cool. Otherwise, the chain reaction will run away, and you'll have a terrible, we were told for decades that a nuclear reactor could not explode. One did explode at Chernobyl, and four have exploded, or three at least, and probably Unit 4 as well, although, as I say, it was not online when the accident happened, have exploded. So we now have had four explosions at nuclear plants. And so the spent fuel pool, the rods there, if they're not covered up, adding to the problem, if they're not covered with water and kept perpetually cool, they're clad in zirconium alloy so that when they're stuck on these grids, this array here, and I'm sorry for going on so long, but it's something everybody needs to know because this is absolutely terrifying, and it's probably the most serious thing that's going on the planet right now today, and very few people know about it. So the spent fuel array is sitting at Fukushima Unit 4, 100 feet in the air. I'm not sure. I'm going to get a clear story if there's water in there or not in the pool. I think they managed to keep some water in there. But God forbid a major quake happen. There's not sufficient structure left at Fukushima 4. It did have a fire. It did have an explosion. And a quake could very easily bring this spent fuel pool crashing down. And the spent fuel rods would then be exposed to the air. And the zirconium alloy that they used to clad the uranium fuel pellets would catch fire. That's how brilliant the design is. We're going to put these fuel rods in a substance that will catch fire when it's exposed to air. But don't worry, we'll keep it covered with water. Well, they haven't been able to keep it covered with water. And so if these crash down to the ground, they'll be just strewn on the ground. There's no way to cover them with water. There's nothing to do with them except watch them burn. And if they burn, God forbid, the radioactive cloud would make Chernobyl look like child's play. And so this is anybody who knows this kind of stuff, Michio Kaku is, of course, a great physicist, brilliant man, genius in many ways, and he's not the only one who's warned about this. In fact, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden went to Fukushima. Apparently, he only drove by. I don't blame him. I wouldn't go anywhere near that place. And I was in Japan. I would not go back to Japan, and under any circumstances now. So he wrote a very strong letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission warning about this situation. And frankly, there's nothing we can do. All the king's horses and all the king's men cannot deal with this fuel pool 100 feet in the air. And, you know, those of us who have kids. And,
I mean, nothing? Like, what about building, you know, more walls around it? I mean, there's just nothing? It's just hope for no earthquake?
Well, the problem is if people get near it, they're going to drop dead. You
right.
can't get people in there. And you can't get robotics in there because the radiation from the fuel pool is so intense that it disrupts the electronics of a robot. You can't do it. And, you know, they were in the middle of the Fukushima crisis very early on. This is an amazing story, actually. Very few people know this one either. Tokyo Electric was just going to pull people out of Fukushima. They were convinced. They knew. I won't say they're, you know, they believed. They knew that people were going to start dropping dead on site during the Fukushima accident. And so they wanted to pull everybody off. And the prime minister of Japan, who's Nakato Nan, who has since become very anti-nuclear, personally went to the work staff. This is the prime minister of Japan personally went to the workers at TEPCO and begged them to not abandon the reactor, not abandon the site, because he was, you know, terrified of what would happen. And so there was, you know, we've seen this movie, The 300, you know, about the Spartans at Marathon, or Thermopylae, I guess it was. But there were about 300 workers, TEPCO workers, Tokyo Electric Power Company workers, who stayed on site at Fukushima and probably saved tens of millions of lives. Because if they'd have walked away, they will all die, by the way. I mean, they're just going to drop dead over the next month and years if they're lucky, or if they're not lucky, because it's a horribly painful death, apparently, from radiation sickness. But these guys, and there must have been some women, too just stayed and probably prevented even worse from happening. And so,
has anybody written about that? Where'd you...
Oh, yeah, that's I think I've got some stuff posted. They were called the 50, actually. Yeah, there's a whole war. Ken, do you know about that?
Yeah, I wrote about
Oh, you did write about it.
I think there was some disagreement. There were certainly allegations, if that's the right word, that TEPCO wanted to leave the premises during the depths of the earthquake. Mm-hmm. But TEPCO since responded to that, saying no, it never wanted to completely leave. All it wanted to do was to send in 50 or so of its most qualified workers to deal with this. So there's some disagreement as to whether or not they would have abandoned it altogether, or whether or not the goal was just to limit the number of workers who were going to go in and deal with that situation. But either way, I think that the prime minister played a key role in minimizing the effects of this accident. Yeah, I mean, and I agree with you that I think there is a movie to be made or a book to be written about those brave souls who to this day remain anonymous, who went in and fought that disaster.
Well, it's an amazing, amazing story to make an incredible movie. If I have to make it in a country that doesn't have a nuclear power industry that will keep it from being made, but other than that, yes, I mean... there was a lot written about it. Ken, I would really love it if you would dig up and email me your article that you wrote about that. Not many people did.
I will. It was, I'll find it. I will. It was near the anniversary of Fukushima, and there was some analysis on the Prime Minister and the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's role, as well as the role of TEPCO. In the NRC, you know, I mean, there's a book to be written there as well, because, you know, it went into crisis mode. And when we talk about crisis mode, oftentimes that word is sort of understated or overstated, rather. But it really was a crisis, and the NRC
in the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Here we have a six reactor complex, actually a 10 reactor complex, two, a six and a four at Fukushima. In the midst of the worst disaster ever in nuclear power, and our own U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission had to respond, and you wrote about this as well, Ken.
I did, and not just the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but the international people as well. I mean, this was, you know, the when you dig into the nuclear industry, I mean, it's a very finite world. It's not the world just keeps going on and on. So once you sort of report on this world, you learn who all the major players are.
Right.
And, you know, they start calling you back. So
that's not all they call you.
Yeah, this was a global effort to... you know, to minimize this disaster. This was not, well, this is Japan's problem and we're just going to go back to work.
Well, let's back up a bit now. We're talking, this is Solartopia Green Power Show with Harvey Wasserman. We got Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post and Ken Silverstein from Energy Biz. Ryan, you have written, since we segued over here to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which many of us have referred to over the decades as no real chance or nobody really cares. But we did have, and we still have, at least for the time being, a chairman who seems to have gotten into his head that he should act as a regulator. Now, you wrote, God forbid, you wrote at your at Huffington Post, Gregory Jasko resigns, Nuclear Regulatory Commission chairman steps down. Now, that is a nondescript headline on a really heavily charged story. Can you tell us about this, please, Ryan Grimm?
Sure, and you guys can fill in the nuclear policy parts of this, because that's not my area of expertise at all. What I'm a political and congressional reporter, and so that's where my interest in this story came from. Jasko was kind of a public interest type of chairman, like you said. He took regulating seriously. He was put on the commission effectively by Harry Reid. Not particularly because
the Senate Majority Leader, Harry,
right, and not really because he's anti-industry, but more because he was anti-Yucca Mountain, and that's Harry Reid's signature issue, is making sure that Yucca Mountain is not used as a waste depository spot. So the four other commissioners on the panel launched a coup against him in October when they sent a letter to the White House saying that he was, unfit for the job for all variety of reasons. That broke out in the open in December when Darrell Issa released it. Some of the commissioners, when the commissioners testified, they said that he was abusive towards women. And my reporting shows that there's zero evidence that's been offered to back that up. And I came across plenty of evidence to show that that's just simply not true. So it was classic kind of, personal destruction of this chairman. He actually beat back the coup, though, and so now here we are 4 months later. His term is up in June of 2013, and here's my read of it. He recognized that there was no way he was going to get through the Senate again, and I think that's an accurate reading of it. There's no way he was going to get Republican support to overcome a filibuster of his renomination, which there absolutely would have been.
So he would have needed 60 votes to be approved by the U.S. Senate. Is that right?
To get a second term as chairman,
right.
Exactly. And there's just no way that was going to happen. And so then once you accept that as a given, then the question is, what's the best move at this point? And so he said, well, I'm going to resign pending the nomination and confirmation of a successor, which, given the Senate, could take the rest of his term. And what it does is it completely defangs his opposition, because Darrell Issa and the NEI are going to have little sway with reporters now if they try.
Okay, well, hold on. Darrell Issa is a very conservative congressman from Southern California, correct?
Yeah, he
invented
power
the
plant in his industry, and he's the chairman of the oversight panel, so he has subpoena power, and he often
conducts investigations. Oh, so he has San Onofre in his district? He has a San Onofre nuclear plant?
That's right. Yep.
Man, that one's shut. That's a whole other, we could do a whole other show on San Onofre. That one's shut because they went in and try to upgrade the steam generator tubes and completely screwed it up. And now that both reactors, well, there's three reactors, and one's been shut a long time, but the other two are now shut too. So Daryl Issa made his fortune in what, car theft devices?
That's right. He's the voice of the stand back protected by Viper. That's actually him.
All right. Well, there's a distinction for you.
Right. So, you know, so the thinking would be that if his commissioners continue to come after him, this is my read of it, that they won't get very far, because a reporter would say, well, look, this guy announced his resignation anyway. I'm not going to waste my time writing about allegations that you're raising about somebody who's on his way out the door. And,
right.
You know, as you and Ken know, the NRC chairman actually can do a decent amount in emergency footing.
Well, he's been a lone wolf there, and Ken, you might want to chime in on this. I've been with the NRC since, I've followed it since before, as Oscar Wilde said about Doris Day, I've been following the NRC since before it was a virgin. It was formed in the mid-1970s. They separated the Atomic Energy Commission. The Atomic Energy Commission's original mandate, as both you may know, was to both promote and regulate. Someone in the 1970s says, well, you know, that's kind of a conflict of interest. So they set up the Energy Research and Development Agency, which became part of the Department of Energy, and then the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which was supposed to be an independent body. Now, in the years, what is that now, 36, 37 years of the NRC's existence, I can only name, I may be missing one or two, only name four commissioners who appeared to be free of, even reasonably independent of the industry. The first was Victor Galinsky, and then there was Peter Bradford, James Hasselstein, and now Gregory Jasko. And Jasko is certainly not anti-nuclear by any stretch of the imagination, but definitely a regulator.
Right.
Ken, what do you think about Jasko's term?
Well, I'll preface my remark by saying that I cover public policy and economics, and I do my very best to stay out of, you know, getting in the mud pits when the political types start slinging it. Sometimes it's necessary to understand that, so that, because it does affect public policy. But you know, there's a broader question here, Harvey, that I think needs to be asked, and I'm not going to answer the question. I'm just going to pose it. Mm-hmm. Are these regulators, should they be political appointees, which in essence the current chairman is because of his connections to Majority Leader Harry Reid, or should they be experts in this industry who fully understand it? And by being an expert, that doesn't necessarily imply that they're wedded to the industries that lobby them, but they understand their arguments maybe that they're making that maybe a political type might not. You know, the current chairman falls into the political category. I'm not sure what his qualifications were in the nuclear field per se. Again, whether or not being detached is a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave that up to others to make those decisions for themselves. But that's the question, I think, that's really the relevant question here.
Ryan, what's your take?
Well,
Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post. That was Ken Silverstein from Energy Biz.
You know, it's a really tough question, because how do you get politics out of this? You know, if the president doesn't appoint these members with the help of the Senate, how do they get there? Do we just make it something like a Department of State, a Department of Nuclear Regulation, or do you put the NRC under the Department of Energy? I mean, you know, whenever you're doing public policy, it runs into politics, and it's really hard to kind of disentangle that.
We're talking with Ryan Grimm.
That's sort of like saying, you know, whenever a judge has to be appointed to the federal bench, is it a political appointment, or does whoever's making the appointment rely on the advice of those out in the legal community to make this decision, and are the people advising whoever's making the decision, are they part of the defense bar or the plaintiff's bar, or, you know, I mean, you can dissect that so many different ways, but certainly an appointment to something as important as the NRC should be more objective than you know, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's pet project or the, you know, his pet peeve, shall we say, which is Yucca Mountain.
Ryan, we're on with Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post and Ken Silverstein from Energy Biz. Ryan Grimm.
Just to answer the other question that he had asked, my understanding is that he has a doctorate in physics with a focus on nuclear energy.
He's plenty well qualified.
Right. So it's not just that he was like an intern at Harry Reid's office that got pushed over there.
Right. I will say that the NRC has a real, you know, from my point of view, and of course I'm a partisan, I hate nuclear power. I want to get rid of it. I would love to see if it was properly regulated. I don't think we'd have any nuclear plants, frankly. And Gregory Jasko, who was on Harry Reid's staff, became chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, appointed, by the way, by George W. Bush, just for the record, has been a regulator, and you know, which the nuclear industry can't handle. And I love it when, just for the record here, I love when the nuclear industry, the advocates complain about how heavily regulated they are, but then they turn around and take federal liability limits on their exposure for major disasters. But we can talk about that further. Ryan Grimm, you've got a piece up at Huffington Post about the resignation of Gregory Jasko. I interrupted you, so what were you about to say?
Nothing in particular, just that, you know, I sympathize with what Ken's saying, and I think we're actually in a way all saying the same thing, that we want people who are regulators first, and that they're not necessarily beholden to any particular politicians or to the industry. I just don't see a path to getting to that. It's certainly preferable to the system we have now, whereas even when you have a regulator like Jasko up there, with the backing of the president and the majority leader, with industry opposition, he still winds up leaving.
Yes, and really the problem is, from my point of view, has not been that the politicians have dominated the process of putting the commissioners on the NRC. It's the industry, and they've all come from the industry. Almost all of them I mentioned before, who have been somewhat independent. And, you know, you get these rubber stamping votes. I mean, you've got four in favor of the industry that they're supposed to be regulating. And now you have four commissioners on there, two Democrats and two Republicans, by the way. I mean, the way it works is that the president in power, there are five seats. And if the president is a Republican, there are three Republicans and two Democrats. If he's a Democrat or she, there's two Democrats, there's three Democrats and two Republicans. So right now there's three Democrats and two Republicans.
Which is why Bush appointed Jasko as kind of a that was his pairing deal with the Democrats at the time with Reid.
Yeah. But the real heavy on the commission in terms of the industry is a Democrat, William Magwood, who's become kind of the hitman for the nuclear power industry on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And of course they cooked up this whole thing about Jasko being mean to women, which was incredibly embarrassing as far as I could tell. And Nancy Pelosi jumped right on it and said, come on, guys, this isn't about Gregory Jasko's attitudes towards women. It's about the fact that he's trying to be a regulator as opposed to a rubber stamp. And he is the only commissioner who has really held his ground on demanding that some changes be made to the American nuclear power industry in the wake of Fukushima. The other four commissioners and the industry as a whole seems to want to ignore the fact that this apocalyptic event is still ongoing in Japan, and we can talk about that in a bit. I believe we're about to take a break here. We're going to hear Dana Lyons, singing the Solartopia song. Ryan Grimm, you're welcome to stay with us from Huffington Post. We're going to talk a little bit more about nukes and the NRC, and then we'll switch over and talk with Ken Silverberg, Silverstein, about renewable energy and that transition. So here comes Dana, the Cows with Guns, singing the Solartopia song, and we'll be back in just a moment. That's the great Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns. Over 2 million hits now on YouTube for that one, Cows with Guns, from Dana Lyons. My buddy got we made a YouTube of that one. He's singing in the woods there with my 9-year-old daughter, who's now 12 and totally embarrassed by the whole thing. But you can come to HarveyWasserman.com, take a look. We are on with Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post and Ken Silverstein from Energy Biz. We've been talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the disposal, the forced resignation of the chair, Gregory Jasko. When he was denounced by his four co-commissioners in front of Congress, God, I've never seen a hearing like that one. Ryan, were you at that hearing, Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post? Did you see that hearing?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Ken, were you there, Ken Silverstein?
I was not. It does sound unprecedented, but...
Yes. So, Ryan, tell us about this hearing.
Well, I mean, it was just funny, actually, because, it started out with a lot of Republicans, the commissioners, bashing Jasko and Magwood, saying he is abusive towards women and that a certain number of women had come to him and complained about his behavior, and that a lot of Republicans asked for Jasko to resign. Then Democrats defended him, and we're trying to get more information out of the other commissioners. And interestingly, by the end of it, Daryl Issa, who knows a good scandal when he sees one and knows when there isn't one, said at the end of it that the five of them needed to work. Work through their differences, which to me was extremely telling. He watched the entire hearing. He saw that Jasko took everything that the commissioners and the GOP side threw at him, and came out kind of okay. And the ISIS comment at the end to me indicated that this was actually going to pass and he was going to survive. And then when it went over to the Senate a couple days later, the Democratic defense of him was that much stronger. Barbara Boxer even told Magwood that he was being McCarthyist, saying, like, I have a list of three women who make these claims, but I can't reveal the list and I can't give any evidence, but it's the truth and you just have to trust me. Bernie Sanders went after him for his the consulting work that he had done for Fukushima. And so it became, clouded enough that it was clear that Jasko was gonna survive through that particular moment.
Ken, you followed the hearing. You weren't there. To me, if I was it was more Stalinist than McCarthyite. But at any rate, we want to move on a bit here. Ken, do you have anything further you want to say about Gregory Jasko and what's happened at the NRC?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay, so I as someone who's been working with the nuclear industry, I got this news, Ryan, from your story, by the way. I mean, I am a blogger at Huffington Post and look at it regularly, hoping to see them posting my latest article, which they usually do. But, so I got the news from reading your story, and geez, I mean, it's a shocker to me.
We did actually break that story, believe it or not.
Well, good for you.
It's our foray into the nuclear coverage.
Good. As we say in the business, mazel tov. So it was a good story. And are you going to be covering the nuclear beat more? Or?
I think I'll follow this particular story as it continues to shake out. I don't really have kind of the bandwidth to make nuclear my only area, though.
Well, I suggest you talk to, and this is just, Ken, you might consider this too. I'm not going to do it because I'm so heavily identified with the anti-nuclear movement, which is perfectly fine with me. But you may want to talk to people like Bob Alvarez, Michael Marriott, Diane Curran, people who have followed the industry over the decades, and count on the fingers of one hand how many NRC commissioners have actually stood up to the industry. And I can only think of four. Galinsky, Bradford, Asselstein, and now Gregory Jasko. And it's been a very, and I was really disturbed when I learned from the Huffington Post that Jasko was gone, because to me that meant that the last even shred of regulatory integrity was gone. And I got to say, these other four commissioners are horrifying to me. They are just, including the two Democrats, Magwood and the other one, they're just in the pocket of the industry. And Gregory Jasko, it helped that he was the chair, it wasn't just Yucca Mountain. He has continued to warn that if we don't do anything to our industry, in the wake of Fukushima, we are worse than derelict. And there are 23 reactors in the U.S. that are identical to Fukushima 1. So this is a story you guys may want to think about looking at, and, you know, the history of commissioners, NRC, and what the level of independence is. I think you'll find it appalling, frankly. Okay, yep. We are at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, Ryan, it's a pleasure. And do keep in touch. Keep writing good stuff. And let us know when Gregory is on his way to Siberia. Let us know when he's going out there, okay?
Oh, you got it.
All right, thank you.
Ryan Grimm. Nice to make your acquaintance, Ryan.
Same here, Ken.
Okay, thank you, Ryan Grimm, from Huffington Post.
Talk to you later.
Take care. For being on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Now we're with Ken Silverstein. Ken, I have been reading your stuff for years on renewables, and your energy biz is more on top of it from the business side than pretty much any other, at least as much as any other industry publication. And if you don't mind, we have 20 minutes exactly left, kind of a state of the art of what's happening with renewables. And especially, I just posted a piece on new tariffs that have been put on the Chinese. So maybe if you can talk a bit about that as well, it'd be very helpful.
In terms of the issues going on with between China and the U.S. or the World Trade Organization, I don't necessarily have my finger on the pulse of those. I don't feel qualified to sit here and give a thorough analysis of it. In terms of the renewable industry generally, I'll make sort of a broad sweeping statement, and then I'll let you try to just dissect it, and then we can carry on a dialogue from there. I think generally speaking, that you know, public policy is really about what people want. I think, generally speaking, there is a desire for cleaner, more efficient use of power generation. And to that end, it requires some type of public support, whether that be in the form of tax incentives or renewable portfolio standards. These things cost money. Relative to the same benefits that have gone to traditional power generation, historically speaking, they are much less. However, on a per annum basis, most recently, they're actually, I think, a little bit more. So it really is a decision as to what the people want. If you want the cheapest power, that's the most reliable power. You know, the coal sector has been doing an adequate job. But those power plants were built, many of them, in the middle of the last century. They're old. They either need to be upgraded or replaced. If you replace them, what do you replace them with? To that end, I think natural gas is sort of the path of least resistance. And even if you choose renewables, they need some type of backup generation, and natural gas and renewables can partner with each other. But then you have the U.S. lawmakers who, either because they're wedded to some of these older industries, or because they're just partisan, or for whatever their reason happens to be, if a company in the renewable sector trips and falls, well, they're just going to pounce on them and just, you know, beat them to a pulp until they can't get up.
Exactly the opposite of what they do to the nuclear power industry.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that aspect of it, but I do think that the beating that the renewable industry has taken, should Solyndra be examined and re-examined and understood, and should the political process by which those loan guarantees were given, should that be examined? Absolutely. Okay. But I don't personally see the nuclear industry pouncing on renewables. I really don't. It's quite obvious, because I think the Solyndra loan guarantee was $500 million, and the one that Southern and its partners got was $8 billion. So it'd be a little hard to say, aha, you know, I told you we shouldn't give those to the renewables.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, there is a people will say they want green power, they want wind power, they want cleaner power. Do they want to pay more for it? You know, do they understand that when the wind's not blowing, when the sun's not shining, that power has to be backed up? And most likely it's going to be backed up with a gas generator. They may need to have a better understanding of these things. There needs to be more transmission to carry these electrons. There's a lot of aspects to this debate that are not understood by the public at large.
Well,
Ken
Silverstein from Energy Biz, can you tell us, in terms of the loan guarantees that are being, you mentioned President Barack Obama, I guess it was 2010 now, right? It was in the year 2010, or was it 2011? I can't remember which. Ostensibly made a big public approval of loan guarantees, $8.33 billion, to build new nuclear plants, to get them done in Georgia at the Vogtle site. That's V-O-G-T-L-E. And, but we learned about a month ago, or a few weeks anyway, much to our surprise, and by us I mean the community of people that follows this, that the loan guarantees were not a done deal. Have you been following this? What is the status of the loan guarantees for the new nukes at Georgia Vogtle?
It was my understanding that it's pretty much a done deal. The major challenge Southern has is to stay on time and on budget. And my best guess would be, and that's all it is that the loan guarantees are contingent upon the company's ability to stay on time and on budget. And if it can do that, the money will be granted. If it cannot do that, and this thing's going to be extended and delayed, and then there's really no sense in putting the people's money at risk. So they have to have some sort of best management practices, and this, of course, is the big challenge.
Well, we know that I posted a piece at Huffington, and which picked up at Huffington. It's at nuclear.org, that they are already another $900 million has been added to the price tag of these two reactors, and that
does not surprise me. I mean, the price keeps going up. That does not surprise me. There's legal costs. There's the price of the steel. There's the price of the labor. And I cover public policy. I don't cover project management. But you have to have people in place that can essentially streamline this deal and make sure that it stays on time and on budget. Because if it does not, the Greens or people like yourself will just club them over the head until they just wave the white flag. But if they can manage to stay on time and on budget, and then demonstrate a level of safety that is certifiable, I would disagree with you, Harvey, and think that there'll be more and more nuclear power.
Yeah. Well, I can guarantee you there won't be, but. who was it? Somebody guaranteed a three-peat for the L.A. Lakers, and they actually did it. So we will guarantee us that there won't be any more nuclear plants if we can stop this loan guarantee from. I don't think it's a done deal, frankly. I do have a petition up linked through nucree.org to sign to stop the loan guarantees. Ken, we're talking with Ken Silverstein of the Energy Biz. Ken, you have an article up today, Google's business approach to building wind energy. Google, the gargantuan search engine internet phenomenon, says, your story says wind energy just got a nice bump. It came after a key federal agency authorized a project funded in part by Google to lay the groundwork for an underwater power line. The offshore wind deal could start putting steel in the ocean. That is a term I haven't heard, steel in the ocean, by 2014. Tell us about this, would you please?
Yes. This is actually a long shot. It's not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination. But the potential, and I don't have this story in front of me, so I can't
recite numbers. Well, I actually do, so you're at a disadvantage on your own story.
Yeah.
But we'll go ahead.
But the ability for offshore wind power to supply electricity along the East Coast is just enormous. It could be an enormous supply of electricity.
All the way up and down the coast. Wind kind of gets slower on a steady basis the further south you go, but certainly north of the Mason-Dixon line,
virtually from Virginia to like New Jersey or something.
Yeah, well, no, Virginia up to Maine and even to Quebec. It's really. Nova Scotia, it's hugely powerful.
But think about the issues here. You're putting the windmills out in the ocean, deep and then you have to somehow transport the electricity that it would generate back onto the coast. So that requires an infrastructure of some sort. And I think the price tag associated with offshore wind energy is at least double that of onshore wind industry.
Yes.
But at the same time, the
capacity factors are home.
Yeah.
The wind blows more steadily.
Yeah, you can. There'll be more electricity, and there's not necessarily these arguments of not in my backyard. Now that doesn't apply to Cape Wind, but it does
Although
apply
it
to
Cape Wind is going to go through.
It would appear that it will go through, but that was a 10-year battle, and we're talking about a wind plant, not a nuclear plant,
right,
or a coal plant.
I will mention, by the way, that the big problem, in my point of view, from the Cape Wind project is that it's privately owned. You have a project going into a public space, the Nantucket Sound there. But private owners are going to make some money off of it. And I had I lived on the Cape, would have strongly objected. I'd support the placement of the windmills, but not the fact that they're owned privately. But go ahead. And you're right, though. Even that did get opposition, but apparently they're close to moving ahead. But certainly offshore in the Atlantic, nobody's going to really object.
There's far broader political support for offshore wind, with the exception of that Cape Wind project, from the people who live on the Cape,
right,
who maintain that the windmills are an eyesore. I don't know what the percentage is. It might be 50-50 on Cape Wind, but in terms of offshore wind, it is broad, and by broad I mean 75-80%. So the obstacle is the cost. So when you have a company like Google with deep pockets throw its name and its weight behind something like this, you know, it is a huge bump.
Well, you said, you say in your article here that Google has already invested more than $915 million in the renewable energy sector.
That's right. And the obvious question from your listeners would be, what is Google's interest in doing this? Google is a search engine. You type in something in its search platform, and it brings you information. So why would Google be interested in the renewable energy sector? Well, you know, in order to perform its services, it has to have these huge data centers, and they are, you know, voracious energy consumers. And, you know, they would like their data centers to be 100% renewable, if possible. And that's
the
their interest.
In California, though, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, they claim it's a, you know, it's a good business proposition. It's not just PR. And they explain, so probably Google would be best able to explain why investing in renewable energy is a profit-making enterprise as opposed to, you know, what others may concern define as a public service.
Well, we can Google that anyway and see what Google has to say. But your piece is very interesting. And now, so you write pretty much daily about the renewable energy business. Is that right?
Yeah, I write. I write. I also, my stories can also be seen in Forbes. And you've contacted me with some of my articles in Forbes.
Yes,
and as you know, I'm an objective analyst here. I don't have any axe to grind as it relates to any of the. I'm not wedded or beholden to any of the groups that I might cover, whether that be nuclear or wind or coal or natural gas. You know, but I write a lot about the renewable sector, and it is right now trying to get up on its legs and get going. And you know, the question I think that will be posed in this presidential election is, are these ventures worthy of public support? And I think generally that the reason public policy is written the way it is because it is widely publicly supported, but it still has to be better understood, because you just can't wave a magic wand and make, you know, 100% clean energy. I mean, the way the breakdown is now is it's something like 45% coal, and coal is falling. It's like 20-some-odd percent, 24% natural gas, and it is rising. It's like 2% renewables, 7% if you include hydro. It's like 20% nuclear. So you have to understand that if green energy is to grow, you know, it's going to grow slowly. Natural gas is probably the bridge to the future. It is the bridge to the future. And green energy may one day mature and become a much bigger supplier of electricity. But today it's just 2% wind, solar, biomass.
Right, although that doesn't really account efficiency, which has made a huge contribution.
Yeah,
we're talking with Ken Silverstein of Energy Biz. Writes a daily article, correct, on energy and a lot of stuff on renewables. Ken, what do you think is the vanguard solar technology? If someone were going to put their, when we first started, you know, fighting nuclear, we had to say, well, we want renewables, and we all figured in the 70s that wind would be the dominant technology. But what do you think? What is going to be the number one renewable technology in 10 years from now?
You know, I don't have a crystal ball, but wind energy is leader, and I don't see it giving up its lead. I think most states have the potential to generate wind energy, where I think solar would be limited to those western states and some of these southeastern states. you know, I think it'll be wind. I think the technologies are advancing, in a very steady way, where cost is coming down and it's getting better.
Good. You know, that's something we're gonna have to. In Solartopia, of course, we all believe that wind and solar are going to take over and get cheaper and better. We've been talking. Thank you so much, Ken Silverstein, for being with us from Energy Biz. We will be in touch. This has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We had Ryan Grimm earlier from Huffington Post talking about what happens at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Ken Silverstein, thanks again. Energy Biz, take a look on the web, everyone, and we'll be back next week with more reports from the Great Revolution in Renewable Energy and Social Justice. See you then.
Thank you, Harvey.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.